But finally, I just want to issue a content warning. I'm going to be talking about slavery, racism, white domestic terrorism, lynching. So it's important to note that up front, and so please be aware of that. And just to sort of lead into the introduction, it's really important to note that up front too, because obviously we're living in a pandemic right now, which is globally disproportionately affecting people of colour. And we're still seeing social justice and Black Lives Matter protests happening on both sides of the Atlantic, in the UK and obviously in the US. And what's really interesting about the figures that I study and try to bring to life throughout these tours is that the people who I'm talking about in the 19th century were essentially campaigning that their Black Lives mattered in the 19th century. And when they came over to Britain and Ireland, and I'll get into the reasons why they were coming over a little bit later, but as they were coming over, they were emphasising this international philosophy of human rights, civil rights, Black rights, which was completely based on their experiences and their testimony. And as early as 1838, on English soil, Moses Roper, who was a survivor of slavery, I'm going to talk about him later, he declared to an English audience, "You have heard the slaveholder's side of the story. It is now time for the slaves to speak." And activists and survivors like Roper recognized that US slavery had completely polluted the American landscape. Now, you have the famous activist Frederick Douglass. Again, I'm going to touch on him later. He declared to an English audience in 1846 that slavery was a cancer that was eating America's vitals. And this language of pollution and a disease almost was really important, and one that activists would use quite a lot. Essentially, Douglass was getting at the fact that slavery was a disease that had quite literally woven itself into the very fabric of American society, politics, culture, and it was quite literally choking the lives out of Black citizens. And again, a few years later, you have another activist and survivor of slavery, the Reverend Henry Highland Garnett. He described slavery in similar ways, and he described the US nation as quite literally, and I'll quote again, staggering under the putrid corpse of American slavery. So all of those activists I've just mentioned, Moses Roper, Frederick Douglass, Henry Highland Garnett, they well knew that instead of getting rid or curing that disease or pollution of slavery, the US had completely failed to live up to its own self-professed declarations of freedom, which obviously is still true for today. And as I'm going to be introducing these stories and these people to you, I'm sure you'll be able to see the parallels between the 19th century and also today, because those legacies of, those legacies of slavery and racism are obviously still with us today, whether it's in the contemporary brutality against people of colour in the US, in the UK, or whether, for example, in Britain, we're dealing with a lot of arguments right now about memorials to or monuments to enslavers or racists and whether those monuments should come down. And obviously those arguments are going on in the US too. And just to give a bit of context too, Britain abolished slavery in 1807, or the slave trade, I should say, and abolished slavery across the British Empire by the end of the 1830s. But in order to enact that abolition, the British government paid enslavers £20 million, which at the time was about 40% of the government's expenditure, huge, huge amounts, billions of pounds today, of course. Now, Black abolitionists like Alarda Equiano, Ignatius Sancho and Mary Prince were really key in enacting the abolition of the slave trade and the abolition of slavery. But what's really interesting is that that notion of compensation towards enslavers and not necessarily the enslaved was something that African-American activists who came to Britain and Ireland spoke about. So you have the Reverend Samuel Ringgold Ward, who said to an English audience, a York audience more specifically, in 1854, that since the Tudor times, British soil was reddened with the blood of my race. And what Ward does in this particular meeting in York is that he talks about the British role in the creation of racism itself, the development of the slave trade, the perpetuation of the slave trade. But he also pointed to the lackluster response of the British government towards its Black British citizens, and specifically spoke about how Black British sailors were docking in American ports on British ships in ports like Savannah and Charleston, they're actually being kidnapped and sold into US slavery, and the British government did nothing about it. So essentially, in several ways, this tour highlights not only the trajectory between activists in the 19th century to today, but actually how far we still have to go to accomplish their anti-racist missions. Okay, so what I hope you'll be seeing right now is a map with certain sort of circles and numbers in it, and I'm going to come to explain that in a little bit. But my research broadly looks at the testimony of African-American activists in Britain and Ireland during the 19th century, with a particular focus on those who survived and managed to escape US slavery. Now, again, just to sort of step back a little bit and provide some context, if you're unaware, slavery had existed in the Americas since the 16th century, and it had become firmly entrenched by the American Revolution. Now, by the early 19th century, the northern states, so states like New York, Massachusetts, for example, had actually gradually abolished slavery. But in the southern states, so Louisiana, North and South Carolina, for example, slavery had become far more entrenched and became part of the economy, the culture, politics of the US South. And it would take the US Civil War, fought between 1861 and 1865, for the legal abolition of slavery. And note, I'm being very deliberate when I say the legal abolition of slavery. But the period that I'm going to be talking about is roughly the 1850s. And by then, about 4 million African-American women, men and children were enslaved across the US South. And it's really important to note that from the beginning, African-Americans resisted their oppression and also their oppressors in numerous ways. So from physically running away from the plantation to form what were called maroon communities in Louisiana and Florida, they ran away to the northern states, they ran away to Canada and sometimes to Britain and Ireland. Actually, on the plantation or the site of enslavement itself, they broke tools, held secret meetings, they fought back against their enslavers or oppressors in so many different ways. Now, for those who managed to escape slavery and perhaps travel to the northern states, they formed the heart of the anti-slavery movement. So Black women and men spoke on anti-slavery platforms about their experiences in slavery. They spoke to a lot of white American audiences about the realities and the brutalities of slavery. They composed their own poetry, which they performed on stage. They also composed their own paintings, which they exhibited on stage as well. Now, there were many African Americans who braved the Atlantic crossing throughout the 19th century to inform transatlantic audiences about US slavery and racism as well. So in the 1840s and the 1850s, a journey across the Atlantic was still very hazardous. It would take sometimes between 10 days and 2 weeks. You could leave somewhere like Boston or New York and you would get into Liverpool, hopefully safely, a couple of weeks later. Now, what's really fascinating about this history, and the nice thing about doing this tour virtually is that I can show you this in a little bit more detail, is some of my research. So I'll share the link to this website, which I've developed in the chat box a little bit later. But this is essentially my attempt to try and map as many African-American lectures as possible across Britain and Ireland. So far, there are around 4,700 speeches on here in about 1,550 locations. Now, what's really fascinating and also slightly daunting is that this is a work in progress. This is a mere fraction of the number of lectures that were given between the 1830s and the 1900s. There were thousands and thousands of lectures given to quite literally millions of British and Irish people throughout the century. And as you can see, so what you can do with the map is you can zoom in a little bit and you can see these numbers start to dissipate. And if you go and zoom in on a particular location, you can click on a particular coloured pin, and that pin will tell you of the activist who spoke in a particular location, the venue, the exact date. Sometimes we don't know that, and any other information. And hopefully what you'll immediately notice is that obviously while there are hundreds of lectures taking place in the London area, there are far more lectures taking place outside of the capital. And as we sort of go up Britain here, you can obviously see a lot of lectures happening in the industrial north of England, Manchester, Leeds, Birmingham, a lot in Newcastle, a lot in Glasgow and Edinburgh. But African Americans were still travelling as high up as the Highlands, the Orkney Islands. They were speaking in large cities as well as small fishing villages. So Cullercoats, on just a few miles outside of Newcastle. They were speaking in Llanberis at the very foot of what is now Snowdonia National Park. They were speaking in Keswick in the Lake District, Bakewell in the Peak District, Ventnor, for example, on the Isle of Wight, as well as Penzance in Cornwall. So quite literally going to every corner of Britain and Ireland as well. And they often relied on anti-slavery networks in order to do this. So there were certain abolitionists that were based in certain locations, so Manchester and Birmingham and Leeds, where they would provide their homes and help support a black abolitionist on their tour of Britain. But as you can see in some of the random villages that I've just named, African Americans ventured off traditional paths as well to inform any kind of audience about slavery. And just while I'm speaking about audiences, they were quite literally speaking to any type of audience that they could get. So upper class and the aristocracy, middle class, working class audiences, and sometimes specifically children as well. And if they went to a particular community that was like a very working class area, for example, sometimes there would be a fee for a meeting, depending on the venue. If it was like a town hall or something, there'd usually be a fee. Obviously a church and chapel, it would be completely free. But if there was a fee involved, activists would often discount that fee so that, for example, working class audiences could actually come and listen. But why were they coming here more specifically? So African Americans were traveling across the Atlantic to, as I've already alluded to, inform audiences about those realities and brutalities of slavery. And they did that in several ways. They did that through speeches, as you can see through this map, but they also did it through their literary work, quite literally writing themselves into history. And they wrote slave narratives. So they were protest documents, small autobiographies that became very, very central to the transatlantic anti-slavery movement, also told incredible and devastating and traumatic stories about what they had experienced in slavery, but also what others had, what they had witnessed on other plantations and things like that. And what's really interesting on this side of the Atlantic in particular is that the commercial and literary success of these slave narratives has actually largely been forgotten. But just to give you an example, you have authors and survivors of slavery like Frederick Douglass, who sold 13,000 copies of his slave narrative between 1845 and 1847. You have Moses Roper, who sold about 38,000 copies of his slave narrative by about 1844. You have Josiah Henson, who sold 250,000 copies of his slave narrative in the 1870s. And when you compare those figures, at least to the initial sales of some Victorian authors that we know today, the results are actually really interesting. So Lewis Carroll, when he first publishes Alice in Wonderland, in about 3 years, he sells roughly 13,000 copies. So Frederick Douglass, 2 decades before, is completely outselling Lewis Carroll, again, at least in initial sales. And then when we fast forward to the end of the century, when Bram Stoker publishes Dracula, the initial sales for that work are only about 3,000 copies. And when you compare it again to a couple of decades before, Josiah Henson's sales are 250,000. It's really quite extraordinary that the history of these slave narratives in the sort of literary landscape of Britain has been forgotten. And I should say these slave narratives were published everywhere. They were published in London, Manchester, Newcastle, Bradford, even Redruth in Cornwall.